It's that time of the year again when we try to better understand who's happy and who's not. The UN World Happiness Report was released this week, offering insights into the multifaceted dimensions of happiness, specifically on how people from more than 150 countries evaluate their own lives. Which country is the happiest in the world? How can happiness be measured given its subjectivity? And perhaps most importantly, how can countries strive to do better? For some answers, we now connect with Professor Christopher Barrington Lee, Associate Professor with the Institute for Health and Social Policy and the Beeler School of Environment at McGill University. Good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Let's start out with who was crowned number one consecutively for the seventh year. Finland has become the world's happiest country in the newly released World Happiness Report. In fact, we hear about the Nordic countries performing well consistently. What are the primary factors that led to higher life satisfaction in Finland?
Well, you're asking a question about causes and causality for something that's very complex, so we don't have a complete answer. But I think that it's safe to say that they have built a society where people feel safe, they feel loved, and they feel useful. Mm. Now, we don't have a perfect measure for those things, and remember that when we talk about happiness, definitions are useful here. But in the context of the World Happiness Report and the Gallup World Poll, where most of these data in the flagship chapter two come from, this is not this ranking that they and it's not me. I'm not an author of this chapter. The ranking is not based on some index or some list of characteristics that the authors have made up. Mm. It's really just the average answer that people in each country themselves give when you ask them the question to evaluate how good their life feels. Mm. So then the main project of the report each year is to shed light on exactly the question you asked, which is why? What explains the differences? What explains the changes? And so then you have to appeal to the other measures that you have. And in the case of the report, they of course focus on measures that come from the same Gallup World Poll, because those are the ones you can apply in a model and a statistical analysis to all the countries. And so those key variables are the following. Maybe I won't list all of them, but to get you to answer what's going well in Finland, people feel that they have friends and family to rely on in times of need. People feel they trust their government. In particular, they think there's not a lot of corruption going on. People feel they have a sense of freedom to make choices in life. Mm. And then those are all actually survey questions. And then the other variables at the national level that are used as key explanatory factors are income per capita, GDP per capita, and healthy life expectancy. Now, Finland does really well on all of those things. And in fact, you know, we can say that it fits the model well. In other words, when you explain every country's average answer all at once with a simple model, Finland is not a surprise that it's on top, because it's doing well on all those things and to the extent that you'd predict.
I think I might want to tie in that answer to why Korea doesn't perform so well. But first, let's look at who else was slipping through the rankings on this year's UN Happiness Report Index. The U.S. didn't make the top 20 cut for the very first time, driven notably by a decline in happiness amongst young people. Now, that sounds devastating even from afar, that the young people wouldn't be as satisfied in their lives, because this is a survey, as you've said, where you answer your own questions, how you feel about the state of the country, how you feel about your sense of community and the government and your country. So what led to the first ever slide for the United States?
Well, it's not the first ever slide. I mean, if you call the top 20 a particular threshold to drop under... But in fact, the United States, and this is true of my country as well, has been on a steady decline on the time frame of more than a decade. So that's taken them out of the top 20, but that's not a surprise given the trend. And indeed, as you say, so the insight from this year's report, and this was new this year, was to break down these averages by age group. as well as by country, so age group within each country. And so some significant part of that decline over the last 10, 15 years is indeed due to the young. But the scale of that is actually unusual. So Canada and the United States have the largest gap, in a relative sense, between those between 15 and 30 and those over 60, as compared to other countries. So in fact, all age groups are becoming less happy in the United States, but something special and unhappy has happened to the young. So as for why, again, we can talk about all of those factors, although, you know, there's plenty of other speculation that wouldn't be a surprise to you probably about things that are going on in the world. It's not clear to us really why North America has a more extreme case of this for the young. And I mean, there are other parts of the world where the trend has been opposite, where the young are becoming happier as compared with the older, right? So there's definitely interesting things to understand. But it's true that people are spending, and the young especially, are spending less time with others than they used to. Uh-huh. And when you ask them the question about whether they feel they have friends and family to count on, they are answering that in less than they used to, and mm-hmm. they also feel less confidence in the government than they used to.
Mm. So they're lacking in the sense of community, as you've said. So and if you're feeling like you need help immediately, that is, would you have somebody to call, for example, to get some help? Do you feel like you belong to the greater good? I mean, isn't that what sense of community is also about? And also, as you've said, trust in the government. I think we can relate from South Korea to generalize just a little bit. What are some of the other notable changes in rankings or other key findings you'd like to point out from this year's report?
I'm not probably going to give you as deep an answer as you would like on this. And I can't speak to exactly why. And again, I think there's, you know, it's raised some as many questions as it should, as it's asked. But Eastern European countries seem to be getting a lot happier, and another feature is that now with the U.S. out of the top 20, I think there are very few countries in those top 20. That have large populations. Mm. So this is sort of interesting, and maybe also relates to, you know, why these Nordic, something else about the Nordic countries. I mean, they have this Nordic model. Why have other countries not been able to reproduce it? Why can the United States or South Korea not, or haven't yet been able to reproduce it? I mean, people have often spoken, well, they're fairly homogeneous populations. They're also not huge, and they're also not very dense, which may be, you know, if you look at the aspects of the quality of life in Scandinavia, one of them is that there is a lot of space, and people actually do like their, you know, to spend time in the country, and they have a lot of access and time to nature, and they value that time. Mm. In any case, that's something interesting. There are big advantages to having a large population and large economy like South Korea does. Mm. And there's also advantages maybe in terms of building trust and social supports to having a relatively smaller, less complicated government system.
Mm. Professor Barrington Lee, I understand increasingly why you're so careful with your wording, because I was thinking South Korea is also homogenous. The U.S. has such a large landmass that it would be all too easy for you to access, you know, the open wilderness or be closer to nature. But if you live in dense cities, it might be different. And it's hard to prove the causal relationship to some of the statements that are being made by media outlets. It's really easy for us to jump to certain conclusions and say, this must be it. We have to learn from the Nordic countries. But is it maybe comparing apples to oranges? It's not like South Korea can become Finland.
That's right. The attitude I've taken to this I'm an economist. I'm supposed to be finding situations where I can really identify causality very narrowly. And that's a very difficult thing to do in social sciences. And I think if you just focus on doing that in life or in research, you restrict the questions that you can answer an awful lot. And sometimes when in complex systems, we do have to say, look, here's a system that's doing well, let's say the Nordic model. surely it doesn't map perfectly onto my country, my culture. But since we don't know exactly which aspects of it are the causes for it doing well, we should think about moving towards a little bit, and we will, of course, be reflecting and making changes and adjustments as we go. So, you know, the general principle of giving people a social security net, giving them a lot of transparency and openness and accountability in government. Those things take time, by the way. I mean, if you want people to trust the government to the degree they do in Sweden, you can't do that in 5 years. You have to, it's a generational effort. So to say, well, these things seem to be working well, we should move towards them, I don't think is a bad way to start, even if you don't have a perfect causal model, as you say, to understand everything.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the tools and indicators used to assess each country's well-being and happiness? I know you mentioned a few at the top of the segment, but it is absolutely subjective, and for that reason, kind of challenging to quantify, isn't it? What is happiness to you? Do you feel happy in your country? The report consistently confirmed that, like you said, communities' high levels of trust are happier and more resilient in the face of crises, but what are the tools that you utilize?
Yeah, in some sense, it's wonderfully simple, right? Because what we've done, and economists have really embraced this approach, partly because it's nice to have a single measure, a scalar value, we'd say in mathematics. And that's what this whole field is about, in fact. It's not about saying, oh, here are the important things in life. It's this and this and this. What we're doing is all of that difficult quantification that you mentioned, we're leaving it up to the individual. So it's a very democratic measure because not only, I mean, we have one question. So the wording is something like taking everything into account. How satisfied are you with your life these days on a scale of 0 to 10? That puts all the burden on every individual. Now, each individual might have a different set of aspirations, a different idea of what a good life is, and certainly different experiences. And they have to somehow think about what is important in life. And then they have to, and you know, which domains of life matter. Then they have to go looking for evidence in their own life. Well, what is evidence? Maybe it's recent affective feelings, recent emotions that they can remember. Or maybe it's recent events that speak to those aspirations. Whatever it is, they've got to go and look at those. And then they have to weight all these different domains that they may feel are important and add them up. And then they have to convert this thing onto this ridiculous scale, 0 to 10. That the question is asking them to do. And so that means that our analysis is really simple in a sense, because we just take these numbers as obviously noisy, obviously in principle problematic, but we don't have a philosophical problem or an ethical problem of how to weight different aspects of life and define what happiness is. We're really leaving it up to individuals. And so that might seem a strange starting point, but after decades of doing this and of working with the data, we're pretty confident that people are doing as close as they can to what we would like them to do faced with this question, and that people are interpreting it and responding actually in similar ways around the world across different cultures and as we translate it into all these languages. So, and the other thing I would say about that question and about its subjectivity. So notice, by the way, it's quantitative, but subjective.
Yes.
Is that it has to be subjective, right? So some people are sometimes very happy to hear that you can put somebody in an MRI scanner and you can find a particular part of the brain that lights up when the person is happy. And you say, oh, so you know, this makes the measure of objective. But of course, you're getting it backwards, because the part of the brain was chosen not based on some other knowledge, but based on the person's claiming that they were happy, right? So it's the thing that you're accountable to is the subjective response. We're complicated people. We're asking about the experience inside the brain. And so if you want to know what is important for well-being, it's ultimately going to be about how something feels to the person in a cognitive and emotional way, all of that. So you really do want a subjective measure at the top. And then ideally, you'd have a lot of other objective measurements about individuals in society, which then you understand how they contribute to that overall feeling of life is good.
Professor Barrington-Lee, I'm sure our Korean listeners at this point are very curious to ask specifically, What about us? South Korea ranked 57th among some 140 countries, scoring 5.95 points on a scale of 10. The ranking moved up slightly, but South Korea still has a high suicide rate among the 38 OECD member nations and also the lowest fertility rate. As an expert on happiness, why do you think many Koreans are so unhappy?
I've got good news for you then, because I think that sounds like last year's data. South Korea, if you're interested, the ranking was 52nd this year, with an average
five
of 6.06.
Okay.
So that's good news. I mean, these are three-year averages, but that indicates a good trend at the moment, unlike my country, so congratulations. So I mean, if you compare, let's say if you compare South Korea to Finland along those same six variables that I mentioned earlier, South Korea has a high income, but it has a little bit less of each of those things than Finland does. And in particular, it has about half as good a response to the freedom to make choices in life question, and about half as much trust in government. So those are a couple of significant differences.
And as you've said, that transparency and trust in government, it's a generational change. It doesn't happen overnight or in a single term of a president.
That's right.
You've actually previously mentioned that policy decisions can be made to improve human lives. In what ways can policymakers and governments use the findings of the World Happiness Report year after year to enhance the happiness of the people? Because that seems to be a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, so this also obviously is not a short-term goal. If it's not too grandiose, I would say that, I mean, I'm really excited about the trend in towards these data at the international level with OECD and other countries that are taking these data very seriously. And so the grandiose way I put this is that our species has never before had the knowledge about what it is that makes a good life. In other words, the causes of high life satisfaction. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of philosophy and intuition and introspection, but to actually be able to measure it in a way that we can do the science and answer the question of what it is that makes people happier, that's new. And so if you ask what governments have been trying to do for the last, for the last century, it's not... Well, if you think it is making lives better for citizens, which I think that's not even right, because we live in a world where, nations are worried about their power vis-a-vis other nations in a military economic way in a sense. But we have the opportunity to do that now, and I really think that's new. So, if that's the direction that government or people want to go, then of course you need to start measuring. As one of the early things, South Korea is a leader in this, right? Because you have been measuring life satisfaction in a couple of your key surveys for a couple of decades at least. I've used data from the CLIPS and the GSS that have life satisfaction in them. That's just a start, because again, that's the outcome. You to build up a science of, well, what is it that explains the changes? And you need a policy framework which really puts human well-being at the center of your policy. And so some countries are really doing this. Mine, for instance, has since 2019 been building a quality of life framework, which has life satisfaction at the center, and then a bunch of measures of things that are, we're more used to measuring. Some of them are new, like the trust and all of these social connection variables, which we didn't used to measure, but we now know are extremely important. And the goal for this framework is really to ultimately be a guide to all budget making, all policy. So if you government wants to know where to spend the next, million won or billion won, we can move towards rationalizing that in terms of how to make people's lives better in the most effective way.
Thank you so much, Professor Barrington Lee, for speaking to us. I was going to ask you, how satisfied do you feel in your own life, but maybe for another time.
Pleasure talking with you.
We appreciate it. If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.